Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am thrilled to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Adam Hochschild, who is the author of several wonderful books, including King Leopold's Ghost, A Story of Greed, Terror, and Heroism in Colonial Africa, and To End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918, and my favorite by far, Bury the Chains, Prophets and Rebels in the Fight to Free an Empire's Slaves. Adam Hochschild, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Good to be with you, David.
It is terrific to have you on here, and I'm going to let you do almost all of the talking, but let me just say very briefly why this is my favorite book. And it is because I have a list of things I want to abolish. I want to abolish war and weapons and fossil fuel use and plutocracy and corporate personhood and health insurance corporations and poverty wages and homelessness and factory farming and prisons and the drug war and the death penalty and nuclear weapons and the United States Senate and the Electoral College and murder and rape and on and on and on. And you told the story of how a group managed to abolish slavery. Is this really the case, that a group of activists managed to abolish something like that?
Well, I'm certainly with you on almost all the items on that long list of things you would like to abolish. And much of my life has been taken up by participating in or writing about social movements. So what I tried to do in Bury the Chains was to tell a story that has long fascinated me about a movement that in some way created the template for almost any kind of activist group today. It was the anti-slavery movement, not in the United States, but in Great Britain, where it started in a big way much earlier than it did here in the U.S. And in many ways, I think it had a harder thing to overcome, because not only was the British Empire highly dependent upon slavery, principally in the West Indian colonies, which were extremely lucrative for sugar planters and the like, but also at the time this movement came to birth, Britain was the world's largest slave trading nation. Of all the captive Africans transported across the Atlantic Ocean during the 18th century, one half of them traveled in British ships. So these ships were delivering enslaved Africans not just to British colonies in the Americas, but to what became the United States, to the colonies of other European countries as well. And so I was fascinated that the world's first really widespread anti-slavery movement began in Britain, in a way that would be as improbable as a worldwide movement for renewable energy beginning in Saudi Arabia today. So this was the story that I tried to tell in Bury the Chains.
So you're talking about some very powerful people losing a lot of money. We are usually told that when you propose that kind of a movement, you're up against insurmountable odds, and it's not going to work. How did it work?
Well, it worked, I think, because of some absolutely brilliant community organizers. They are not what we think of as community organizers today. It was a group, the first time that this group that really made the breakthrough assembled, it was 12 people, all men, most of them businessmen, most of them Quakers, who met in a London Quaker bookstore and printing shop on May 22nd, 1787. And they formed themselves into a committee with the aim of ending first the slave trade and then slavery itself in the British Empire. And to me, that is an absolute landmark moment in the history of human rights. There had been in Britain up to that time various people who had written pamphlets against slavery. What little argument had been carried on the subject in public was carried on mainly in the form of pamphlets and sermons and books citing the Bible, some people citing the Bible in favor of slavery, some people citing the Bible against slavery. but it in no way had caught on with the public. This movement caught on. Now, it's fascinating how you measure whether something catches on. There were no Gallup polls in those days, of course. But there was a very interesting, very public barometer of public opinion in London at this time. One of the great spectator sports in England of the 18th century was public debates. And, you know, people paid sixpence or whatever to hear two speakers debate all kinds of subjects. You know, the role of women, whether the franchise should be widened beyond the 5% of Englishmen who could vote at that time. Sometimes frivolous topics, you know, such as whether women wearing large hats should be banned from theaters and so forth. Well, for decades, there had been virtually no debates about slavery or the slave trade. Suddenly, in the month of February 1788, less than a year after this first crucial meeting, one half the debates in London debating societies were about the morality of slavery. So this was a movement that figured out a way to reach the public's heart. And I got fascinated by how they did this. And in Bury the Chains, I tried to tell that story. And I realized that there were all kinds of things that we take for granted today in organizing to bring about change, which this small group of people really pioneered. For example, the idea of having a national organization headquartered in a nation's capital with local committees or groups or chapters scattered around the country. Something we take for granted today, you know, the Sierra Club, headquarters in Washington and, you know, groups around the country. That this was almost unheard of at the time. Britain in the 18th century was a highly religious society. One of the things that made this committee unusual was that it was people from different religious sects coming together to work together for a secular aim. That was almost unprecedented. Then you look at the techniques they used. For example, one of them I'm sure most of your listeners have seen. Everybody has seen at one point that diagrammatic picture of a slave ship that shows you, you know, deck by deck, slaves' bodies lying down to show how many slaves they could pack into a single vessel. It's on the cover of half the books about slavery. It's in every TV documentary about the slave trade. Bob Marley used it on a record cover and so forth. Very common image. This image was drawn for the first time by a local committee of this anti-slavery group in the port of Portsmouth. And it was based on a particular slave vessel called the Brooks, which sailed out of Liverpool. Actually, the image is rather conservatively drawn because it shows fewer bodies than we know from shipping records that ship carried on some of its voyages. As soon as this abolitionist committee saw this image, they realized how powerful it was. They saw it had a huge effect on people. They printed off 8,000 copies of it and put it up in pubs all over England. It was the first widely distributed political poster. Something else that this committee came up with in 1787 was the first logo ever designed for a political organization. It was the image of a kneeling slave in chains, surrounded by the legend, "Am I not a man and a brother?" Question mark. And this began appearing everywhere. It was a way for people to show that they supported the movement. People wore it on their coat buttons, on women's hat pins. They used it as a seal for sealing wax. It went onto book plates and all kinds of things. First logo ever used for a political organization. But I think there were some more important things as well that these folks discovered. As I mentioned, all of the argument about slavery that had been carried on at that point, up to that point in time, had mostly been in terms of citing the Bible. What this committee discovered was that what really moved people to outrage and to action was not biblical quotations. It was eyewitness testimony by people who had seen slavery in action, sailors on slave ships, ships officers, people who had worked on West Indian plantations, who'd then come back to England and were willing to talk about what they'd seen. They got some of these people to write pamphlets, to write books, to testify before Parliament. They put together a very carefully edited compendium of their testimony, and they found it had huge impact. And this, of course, is what investigative journalists try to do today, giving firsthand accounts of something outrageous that's going on. One guy from the Abolition Committee, just to give an example of the sort of thing that they did, was a man named Zachary Macaulay actually sailed on a slave ship from Africa to the British West Indies as a passenger. He slept at night in the slave quarters, slung his hammock there, and then he wrote about what it was like. Now, the word investigative journalist hadn't been invented at that point, but if anybody was a great investigative journalist, he was. Finally, just to give one more example of what these early British abolitionists invented, they really devised the first really widespread consumer boycott. When, after 5 years of agitating, the British Parliament had still failed to pass the anti-slavery legislation they wanted, more than 300,000 people in Britain stopped eating slave-grown sugar from the West Indies. This was the first really widespread consumer boycott, and that also is a technique that we use today.
It's a remarkable combination of tactics and tools, and perhaps some of them were more powerful because of their novelty. I don't know. We're speaking with Adam Hochschild about his book, Bury the Chains. It also seems that you're describing something we're told that cannot happen. You're describing a movement to move people to, on a moral issue, to care about people very different from themselves, very far away from themselves. We're always told you must appeal to people's most base self-interest or you're not being strategic. We're also told that if you engage in this sort of educational, culture-shifting activism, you're not serious. The only way to be serious is to put your energies into electoral campaign work. But here you're describing a society where 95% of the men didn't vote and 100% of the women didn't vote. So it's unlikely that voting was a big factor, if a factor at all here. How can this be? This seems to be against the laws of modern activism.
Well, first of all, anytime you try to do something really important, to change something really important, to eliminate a major injustice, people are always going to tell you it's impossible. But you know, this book has had an interesting history. I published it 7 or 8 years ago, and the last 4 or 5 times people have invited me somewhere to give a talk based on the book. It's not been college history departments. It's not been groups or people interested in slavery. It's been groups working on global warming. Because there, too, this is the major problem that faces us today. It's something where everybody working on it says, oh, it's impossible. You know, you'll never wean people off this heavy energy consumption diet. You know, we got to find some sort of technological fix. You know, either build hundreds of nuclear power plants or somehow fiddle with the atmosphere. You know, people are being told it's impossible, but I'm fascinated that people involved in this movement are looking to something that happened that began 225 years ago when another group of people was told that something was impossible, but nonetheless they persevered and they did make a huge change. I was fascinated actually to see that Bury the Chains was actually reviewed in a scientific journal for climate scientists by a Swedish climate scientist who said, look, if we want to change things, we've got to look at the model of what these folks did way back then.
Well, I have to tell you that this book is also widely read in a group whose existence may be so little known that you wouldn't imagine there was such a thing as having it widely read there, but among people who are working for the abolition of war making, which is so prominent today as slavery was back then. And it's interesting that we also run up against the fact that you're talking about a slavery abolition movement that didn't use a civil war. Americans often are under the impression that if you want to get rid of slavery, you must have a civil war to do it.
That's the way it happened here, yeah.
But why didn't it happen that way anywhere else? And why was it necessary here, but not necessary everywhere else?
Well, I think some places it was. If you look at Haiti, for example, which used to be a French colony, the Haitian Revolution, a long and very bloody affair, was really what took Haitians out of slavery. And they had to fight for it because France was determined to keep them enslaved, and there was no domestic anti-slavery movement to speak of within France, even though there were a small number of good-hearted French people like the Marquis de Lafayette who opposed slavery, but it wasn't a powerful movement. But in the British Empire, the remarkable thing is that the end of slavery was brought about by a combination of slave revolts in the West Indies and by this extraordinarily powerful movement back home in Britain. Why did it happen this way in Britain and not in the United States? I think for a couple of reasons. In a way, the anti-slavery movement in Britain had a somewhat easier task before it than, say, an anti-slavery movement in the American South would have had, in that there were no slaves in Britain itself. And the people who benefited from slavery were a small and clearly defined group, the owners of West Indian slave plantations, the owners of ships that trafficked in slaves, and so forth. And so it was perhaps easier to stir people to outrage about something which they didn't feel put them at risk of losing their jobs. In the American South, even though only a minority of white people owned slaves, I think slave owners were extremely effective at convincing non-slave owning whites that their jobs would be at risk if the slaves were freed. Suddenly there would be competition for their jobs.
It does seem like the model of war in our day and age, when the wars are not here in the United States, and victims from Yemen and Pakistan come and tell their stories in Washington. There were former slaves, including a man by the name of Equiano, who played a big role in the story you told of the anti-slavery movement in the United Kingdom.
That's right. Olaudah Equiano, a remarkable man whose autobiography, the first full-scale autobiography of a British slave, has been rediscovered in the last 30 years or so, and many people read it now in college courses. It's an amazing book. He was a slave in the British West Indies. There's some dispute over whether he was actually born there or born in Africa and then brought to the West Indies as a youngster. But in any event, there's no doubt that he was enslaved in the British West Indies, and then he earned his freedom. That is, he earned enough money on the side, mainly by trading, to buy himself from his owner. Then he made his way to England, settled in London for most of the rest of his life, worked at a number of different trades as a sailor on ships, as a barber, doing various other things, married an English woman. And then in 1789, he wrote his autobiography, and it was the first full-scale life story of a British slave, and quite well told, and told in very personal terms. There was actually another former British slave living in London who wrote a book actually a year earlier, but only about 4 or 5 pages of it were autobiographical, and the rest of it was all this philosophical argument, which didn't have much impact. But Aquiano's had a huge impact. He was also kind of a natural self-promoter, and he in fact went on a what was really a 5-year book tour around the British Isles, and his book became a bestseller. And it coincided with the flourishing of this movement, I think, had a terrific effect. He was friends with some of the people in the movement, and that kind of eyewitness account really helped him a lot.
Adam Hochschild, it is an amazing book, Breaking the Chains, but you have so many amazing...
Bury the Chains.
I'm very sorry, Bury the Chains. It's sitting here right in front of me, and I said it wrong. But you have so many wonderful books. I wonder if we can't touch on another one in the time we have, and that is To End All Wars. What, or maybe I should say, who is that book about?
Well, this is a story that's long fascinated me. The First World War, who the centenary of whose beginning we will mark next year, has always been a source of fascination for me, as it has been for many people, I think. A war that was utterly senseless, that remade the world for the worse in every conceivable way, that could and should have been avoided, that wasn't really fought over anything. No country in Europe publicly claimed a piece of another's territory, for instance, the sort of thing that wars really usually begin over. Germany was Britain's largest trading partner. The royal families of Britain, Germany, and Russia were all cousins and used to go on vacations together. People were getting along with each other quite well. But through a sort of series of accidents, plus everybody being armed to the teeth, and wanting to mobilize their army before the other guy could mobilize his army, through that series of accidents, this war started. Everyone expected it to be swiftly and victoriously over. Both sides planned on swift victory. Both sides thought that winning the war would solve various problems they had, but as is almost always the case, and is certainly the case if you look back at the last few wars the United States has been involved in, victory is never swift, and wars usually create far more problems than they solve. And that was certainly the case in World War I. Without it, can you imagine World War II happening? I don't think so. Not to mention the 20 million or so military and civilian deaths that came from World War I itself. So it's always fascinated me. But the problem is this. When people write the history of World War I, they always do it in terms of a battle between two sides. Britain, France, eventually the United States on one side, Germany, Austria-Hungary on the other, and so forth. I wanted to tell this story as a battle between people who thought the war was a noble and necessary crusade and people who thought it was absolute madness and refused to fight. There were anti-war movements in all of the major belligerent countries. They were not, unfortunately, strong enough to stop the slaughter, but they were there. The place where that conflict was most dramatic was Britain, because 20,000 British men of military age refused to go into the British Army when they were drafted. Many of them, as a matter of principle, also refused the alternative service that was offered for conscientious objectors, because it meant working in a war industry or driving an ambulance at the front or something like that. And more than 6,000 of them went to prison. Up to that point in time, the largest number of people ever imprisoned for political reasons in a Western democracy. And happily for me, in prison, they kept diaries and wrote letters and published clandestine newspapers on toilet paper and this kind of thing. So I tried to tell a story focusing on England as a conflict between people like this who refused to fight in the war and people who willingly joined in and thought the war was a glorious crusade that had to be won. And I always like to try to bring a piece of history alive by following 10 or 12 characters through a piece of history. And in this book, most of my characters are members of three different families. Each family included both pro-war and anti-war people.
And it is those stories that make the book so engaging. It strikes me, we don't have many minutes left, but many of those resistors resisted in part out of a sense of internationalism and the foolishness of pitting nation against nation. But that internationalism that was so present on the left before the war did not prevent the war as some had expected it might. Why that failure, why that collapse of what we would call progressive movements today when the war began?
Well, unfortunately, we human beings tend to be very tribal creatures. Before the First World War began, right up to the last minute, people on the left expected that, you know, here was a Europe where there were more than 10 million socialist voters. They expected that the working people of you know, France would never go to war against the working people of Germany, and, you know, representatives of the left-wing parties had been gathering in international conventions for years and years and were good friends with each other and so forth. And, of course, preached that, you know, the real enemy of the working class was the capitalists and not people from another country. But when the war began, that appeal to tribalism that all countries make when there's an attack, and, you know, we saw it in this country most recently, September 11th, 2001, suddenly the flags come out, you know, people are playing taps at high school football games, you know, there is a kind of appeal to tribalism which countries very effectively make in wartime, when they are attacked or claim that they are attacked or claim that they're about to be attacked. And that's exactly what happened in 1914. And you can just watch, and this is one of the things I focused on in the book, people, you know, who had such hopes for the, you know, the international socialist movement, feeling crushed when they saw their comrades so willingly go into the army. It happened in Germany, it happened in Britain, it happened in France. So we need that kind of internationalism. We don't need any more tribalism in this world. And that remains as true today as it was in 1914.
And that is an excellent note on which to end this program and to work on in the days ahead. Adam Hochschild is the author of several wonderful books, including To End All Wars and Bury the Chains, Prophets and Rebels in the Fight to Free an Empire's Slaves. Adam, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Okay, thank you, David. It was a pleasure being with you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.